Welcome to ID the Future. This is Sarah Chaffee. Joining us on the show today is Dr. Brian Miller, who holds a BS in physics with a minor in engineering from MIT and a PhD in physics from Duke University. He is a technical consultant for IdeaShares, a virtual incubator dedicated to bringing innovation to the marketplace, and serves as research coordinator for the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute. In a previous podcast, Dr. Miller talked about the difference between macro and microevolution in terms of what are called fitness terrains. Today, he's going to apply that idea to the evolution of the eye. Welcome back, Dr. Miller.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You wrote about the eye in a few of your articles. Would you please explain how your analysis would apply to that organ?
Certainly. And just as a review from my last podcast, is when you think about evolution, you can think of it in terms of what's called a fitness terrain. And that's essentially like a landscape of mountains and hills and valleys, where going uphill means going to higher fitness, a superior organism in terms of survival, and going downhill is going to reduce fitness. What happens is you can imagine microevolution in terms of navigating around a local peak of a fitness terrain. If you ever climbed up a mountain, you may have noticed as you get to the top, you might have gentle valleys moving up and down. And that's kind of what happens with microevolution. So you have, for instance, a finch, and the beak can become slightly different over time. It can become thicker or thinner or larger or smaller. So you're essentially on top of a high mountain with a finch, and you're navigating the top of that mountain through the gentle valleys and hills on the top of the mountain. Now, macroevolution is very different. Macroevolution represents going from the top of one peak or even going up one peak to the top of another peak. And that can never happen because in order to go from one peak to another, you have to go downhill into a valley and up to, and then back uphill to the new peak, which natural selection will never allow you to happen. Now, that's theoretical, but when you actually apply it to living organisms, that model I described is very, very clear. And let's talk about the evolution of the eye. Because what's happened is evolutions have claimed to provide a detailed, believable account of how an eye evolved. And the basic idea is you start with an eye spot. You then get, let's say, a concave cavity where you can get shadows. You then get maybe some gelatinous material that can act like a lens. It then becomes like a true lens, and then finally a modern camera-type vertebrate eye. Now, that sounds like a great story if you ignore all details. But as soon as you look at the details in terms of fitness terrains, it collapses. Because what does it actually take to get a vertebrate camera-type eye? Well, what happens is there's a lot of details. You have to essentially reprogram the developmental biology. And again, when I say developmental biology, as many of you listeners have heard, it's basically what you're talking about how an egg develops into an adult. That process of cell division, of cell migrations and differentiation, and finally the formation of the adult. Well, to get, let's say, just the lens of an eye, what happens is you have to create a whole new developmental circuit. Essentially, you have to have some tissue that migrates into a region where the eye will form. You then have to have it differentiate into a lens. You then have to have the lens fill with a material called a crystalline protein. You've got to have special channels at that point to allow for nutrients to migrate. It has to have the right shape. And there's several other features that have to take place for this lens to work. Now, what happens is until all those steps come into being, the lens is actually going to be a detriment to the organism. So if you have a lens or a piece of tissue that's about to become a lens, and it's not transparent, what it's essentially going to do, it's going to block the light from going to the retina. So what happens is you're actually going downhill in terms of the fitness terrain, and you're going across a long terrain of less functional impaired vision eyes long before you go back up the terrain and you actually have a functional lens which actually works properly.
Would the lens then enable the animal to see images clearly?
That's an excellent question, because I've only begun the story. Because let's imagine you have a miraculous set of mutations which actually gives you a lens which is somewhat functional that helps to focus light onto the retina, kind of like a box jellyfish. Well, you could imagine at that point that natural selection could slightly improve the lens over time to improve the, let's say, the crystalline concentration to improve the focus. And that's all fine. But what happens if you want to go from, let's say, a highly functional lens to one that actually focuses light to form a sharp, high-resolution image. Well, now that's extremely complex, because to get a high-resolution image, what has to happen is you have to have these proteins called crystallins that alter the index of refraction in a very precise mathematical way. So the index has to be higher in the middle and lower on the outside to get a sharp image. Now, in addition to get a very sharp image, you have to then have feedback circuitry in your eye and into your brain such that the lens can actually focus. So for instance, in a fish, the lens actually moves forward and backwards to be able to focus on an image that's at different distances. In the eye, what happens, we've got special muscles that cause the lens to contract in order to focus properly. Now, even if those miraculous mutations took place, you're still not going to be able to give an advantage to the animal, because a high resolution image is useless unless you completely restructure the retina to be able to process things like edge detection, motion detection. And then that's not even helpful until you restructure the brain to take that pre-processed image and then be able to process it at higher and higher levels, have contour resolution, identify images, and then eventually you have to reprogram the brain to identify the images like a fish and then know what to do with those images. So the brain has to know to, let's say, flee a shark and pursue potential food. So unless all that takes place, a high-resolution image is completely useless and actually could present a selective disadvantage, because what you're doing is you're focusing the image on a very small set of photoreceptors, so you're no longer able to do the bulk imagery like detect shadows and detect, let's say, a mangrove that the eye was originally designed to produce. So in other words, what happens is going from an eye without a lens to an eye with a lens is a selective disadvantage until all these details are right. And also, going from, let's say, a decent lens to a very high resolution lens is a selective disadvantage until a lot comes into place.
Does eye evolution face any other challenges?
Well, I was just talking to the problem of fitness terrains. So in other words, to get a lens, you actually have to go against the selective pressures, which is an enormous problem. But even if that wasn't a problem, even if you imagined that the fitness terrain was perfect, so that all the selective pressures would favor the evolution of a lens in a step-by-step process, it still wouldn't work. And the problem deals with what are called waiting times. Now, a waiting time essentially is how long does it take for a certain coordinated set of mutations to come into being, which will allow something to function properly. So in the case of the lens, let's break that problem down to one step, one of 1,000 steps to get a lens. And that one step is to take what are called the crystalline proteins and have those proteins fill up the lens to create the refractive index that you need. Now, that would seem very simple because the crystalline proteins already exist in cells. They're used for other purposes like heat shock responses. Now, all that would seem to be done is you just simply have to take the gene that produces a crystalline protein and cause it to launch at the right time and place in the right amount in your lens. Well, the problem is, when you look at what that requires, you have to essentially reprogram the regulatory regions in the crystalline gene. So let's imagine you have the first crystalline gene. What you have to do then is you have to allow that gene to bind to what are called transcription factors. So what you have are these special proteins called transcription factors. And when the right factors bind to the right gene at the right time, it then launches the gene so the protein is produced. Now, to get the crystalline proteins to be produced in the lens at the right time and the right amount, you're going to need well over 4 new transcription factor binding sites in the crystalline gene and other related genes, which are essential to produce these proteins at the right time and place. Now, what happens is each transcription factor binding site, which is essentially a set of DNA, it's a sequence of DNA that's a bit away from the actual protein coding part of the gene, you have like a series of 5 to 15 nucleotides or base pairs that have to be properly encoded to allow the transcription factor to bind properly. So if you're talking about 4 separate transcription factors, you're talking about a sequence of base pairs in the DNA, which is well over 30 base pairs. Now, what happens is some of these sequences are redundant, meaning they don't have to be exactly right, or they don't have to be the exact same sequence to cause a transcription factor to bind. You may have multiple options. So let's take the number 30 plus and divide by 3 to get 10 transcription factors. So that deals with sequence redundancy. That deals with the fact that you might start your sequences at different locations. And that also deals with the fact that a quarter of all the nucleotides would be correct purely by chance, since there's only 4 nucleotides. Well, that means you still need over 10 mutations to launch these crystallines at the right time and place. It's kind of like the launch code to a missile. You have to have all the numbers of your launch code correct before the missile launches. And the same is true with these mutations that you need. They all have to be there, or else you're not going to get the crystalline to launch at the right time and place in the right amount. Well, the question is, how long is it going to take to get 10 coordinated mutations? Well, the time scales are well beyond the time available. So to do a very simple calculation, if you assume that, let's say, a mutation happens in a chance of 1 over 100 million, which is roughly what you see in vertebrates, well, that means in 10 million years or 10 million generations, we'll assume that a generation time is a year. That's short, but we'll assume that. There's only a 1 in 10 chance to get a mutation that would allow this launch to take place. Well, to get 10 mutations, that's like a chance of 1 in about 10 billion in 10 million generations. Well, very few organisms are going to have an effective population that high. What that means essentially is that in a period of 10 million years is not enough time to do that one simple step of launching the crystalline protein in your lens in the right time and the right amount. That's just one step. But that's one of many steps to get the lens to form properly. And the lens is simply one of many steps to get a functional eye and a functional visual system. Now, what that means is the time scale problem is astronomical, and even if the fitness terrains were perfect, it wouldn't work. This same problem is something that you would see in virtually every major transition that's claimed by evolutionists, whether you're talking about the evolution of a land animal to a whale, or the production of, let's say, the defense system of your immune system. It doesn't really matter. The key is, when you look at the problem of fitness terrains and the problem of timescales, it means that every single evolutionary scenario for anything complex collapses when examined in detail.
Well, thank you for joining us today on the show, Dr. Miller.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being here.
This has been Sarah Chaffee for ID the Future. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.